I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, T from San Diego. Hey.
Wow. Good evening. My name is T, and I am an alcoholic. Where do I start? Okay, I'll start at the beginning. If you start that, I'm going to knock the hell out of you. You know, do you want me to speak louder? You know, today I get to joke. I get to kid around. I get to laugh. I get to feel happy 99% of the time. Can't take away my happiness. Whereas, where do you want me to go back to? How about 1967? It's a great year. You know, I was a junior in high school, and there was no rules about me drinking in the house. My mother was an alcoholic. My stepfather was an alcoholic. Grew up in New London, Connecticut, little rural place, which was the submarine capital of the world. And I grew up this... I want to call myself privileged because my grandparents had a house that was on a beach. And in the summertime, that was where we all hung out, on the beach. You know, and in 1967, I decided to take this trip. This trip that started with huffing a dope-based turpentine. And I used to go up and back at St. Joe's Church, which was about a half a mile up the road from the house. And I used to sit in the back, and I used to have this little plastic bag and a rag inside the bag, and it had that dope-based turpentine. And I did it three times. And the third time is when I got busted. God had a plan in store for me, and it wasn't what my plan was. And I found myself... that last week of this little binge that I was on, drinking a half a gallon of scotch. And it got to that place where at the end of drinking that half a gallon of scotch, I was putting water in it. Also, my grandfather wouldn't catch me. But little did I know, he was sort of following me with that bottle of scotch because my grandmother was in the hospital. My grandmother was in the hospital because that night I had gone out with my friends, and there were seven of us in a Fiat 850 coupe. And we got into a car accident. We were crossing a four-way intersection, and this car, which was a 1955 Chevy, came from nowhere, doing about 80 miles an hour, and tagged us. And when it tagged us on the rear end, the car went spinning around. Spun around seven times and flipped over five. I went flying out the back window. I came out with a broken collarbone. My girlfriend at the time was this beautiful brunette. Long brown hair all the way down to here. And she was French. And that night, they came to the hospital to pick us up. And when I say they, that was our parents. My grandmother was one of them. And her father brought us home and dropped us off at the house. And on his exiting, he shook my hand and he said, "It was nice knowing you, but I choose to not let you date my daughter no more." And that was my heartbreaker. And so I went out and I finished off that bottle of alcohol. And I found myself in Norwich State Hospital for 2 weeks. And I don't know if you know about state hospitals back then. There were no treatment centers. And I was under the committed indulgence of this drug that they put me on to sedate me. And in coming to, I didn't realize that everybody that was in a mental institution, or pretty much most of the people that were in that mental institution, had lobotomies. And this guy sat down next to me, and he was jerking off. And I had no clue what the hell he was doing because I was in that fog. But I kept feeling his elbow going against me like that. And when I looked over at him and I saw what he was doing, I started screaming like a little girl, screaming at the top of my lungs. And they took me back in my room and they gave me another injection. And they knocked me out. And when I got out of that place, I had to go to a psychiatrist for a year. And this psychiatrist put me on a antidepressant. Yeah, that's what they put me on. And they kept me on these antidepressants for long periods of time, and I used to have to go on Saturday afternoon and see the psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist, I didn't understand. He was Russian. How the hell could I understand? You know, he spoke with that funny accent. But in our conversation, he always used to start talking about shit and how it would be nice to be able to power our vehicles with shit. You know, so this was the craziness that was going on in my brain when I got sober that first time. Because, you see, I never went back to huffing that dope-based turpentine. I never went back to drinking that whiskey. I never went back to drinking that brown alcohol. From there, it was that white alcohol, that stuff that really made you crazy. And it was onward and upward towards the light. And I got to go to places like the Newport Jazz Festival. And that was a hell of a cool place, you know. And I got to hear groups like Blood, Sweat, and Tears. And I don't know if you remember Blood, Sweat, and Tears, but they were playing Blood, Sweat, and Tears out on the beach this particular night. And all I saw was a whole bunch of people coming towards the gate, and they crashed the gate. And that was the last of the Newport Jazz Festivals that they had for like 10 years. You know, and I even missed Sly and the Family Stone. He was one of my favorite groups, you know. And then came Woodstock. Woodstock was fun for the first day that I remember. The rest of what I remember of Woodstock in the 4 days that I spent there was mud. People walking around nude, people passing joints, people drinking a whole lot of drinking, and people passing around whatever they were passing around that made you get a little psychotic, you know, and I didn't want no parts of that. So I stayed with the drinking and the marijuana usage. And I found myself under my sleeping bag on a number of nights, but then I also found myself in that sleeping bag with other people that I didn't know. You know, and my life started getting like that. It started getting out of hand. It started where I had no control. And I was a good Catholic boy. I grew up as a good Catholic boy. And trust me, my knuckles to this day still don't function right because of the way that those nuns used to beat the shit out of my hands. You know, I started out as a left-hander. I started this life as a left-hander. And them nuns beat me so bad, I had to turn to the right hand. You know, this was the way my life was. It was treating me as though I was a third-class citizen, and it wasn't treating me as though I was a first-class citizen. Because I had no say in my life. I had an alcoholic for a mother. I had a missing-in-action dad. Didn't know until I was 50 years old that he wasn't missing in action. It was my mother ran him off. My mother wanted no parts of this man. And when my father came out when I was 50 years old, we took him to the casino. And we took my mother to the casino. And from the time that my mother got in that car until we got up to the casino, she beat the shit out of that man. For shit that took place 50 years ago. She sat in that back seat and he was sitting in the front seat and all she was doing was reaching around. Bah! You know, and I got to see this behavior. You know, and it was outrageous to me. But my behavior was no better. My behavior was no different. You know, and I started getting these great jobs. right out the box. You know, I started life as a draftsman. I worked for a company called Litton Industries. And they sent my dumb ass to Pascagoula, Mississippi in 1972. And I got 41 speeding tickets in less than 30 days for sitting still in the parking lot. And this big white cop would come up to me every day and say, "Where you going, boy?" I'm from Connecticut. You don't call me boy. Don't you know who I am? And you know, my attitude started getting worse and worse and worse and worse because of this guy. And then we started going to, because there was 172 black engineers down in Pascagoula, Mississippi. Most of us from New London, Connecticut. And we started complaining about the treatment we were getting and the tickets we were getting. And the cop being in the parking lot just giving us tickets, just we were not even driving, you know, 2 miles an hour to the stop sign, you know. And we complained about it enough that the director of engineering went to the governor of the state and said, "Listen, I have my engineers down here. I have my draftsmen down here. Either this stops or we're going to pull the contract and we're going to start working out of another state." And you know, next day that cop wasn't in that parking lot. Our boss was asking us for all those tickets so he could give them to the governor. They were all reversed, each and every one of those tickets. But Pascagoula, Mississippi left a very, very big mark on me. It showed me man's inhumanity to man. It showed me man's intolerance. And it showed me that I wasn't a person. I was less than. And this was something I was always taught. I am less than you are. Because I have to work twice as hard as you do. Because I am a person of color. And this was instilled upon me. You know, no matter how good my family did, I was always instilled upon, you need to do better. You need to do the best you can. And sometimes I was doing the best I can, and it still wasn't good enough. You know, but this is the way I grew up. You know, and I didn't grow up in the fast lane, but I got in the fast lane somehow. And then my family moved, like I said, out here to California. I always had two jobs. I worked for whomever I worked for on one token, and then in the other token I worked catering. Well, that was my job. They put me in the right spot because I was the bartender. I metered out what you drank, but I got to drink even more, you know? And my crew can attest to this factor, that they drank just as well as the clients that were coming to the party. You know, my oldest sponsee who's sitting over there, he's grinning like a Cheshire cat. Sorry, I do stutter. He, too, is from Connecticut. And he became my sponsee 24 years ago. He followed me into this program using me as his test dummy. Because, you see, he needed somebody to follow. And apparently I looked good enough to follow. You know, and my life started getting different when I got sober. I'm not going to spend too much time talking about what it looked like, how it was. Because I just gave you an insight as to how it was. But, you know, my life was always in a place where I was always creating a lot of money. I was always able to make that money. I was always able to take care of myself and anybody else because, you know, let's face it, working catering, when the party was all over with, one of the things that we got were the gratuities. It wasn't about the $10 an hour we got. It was the gratuity. Hell, I would work the air show for 3 days and walk away with $4,500 in my pocket. Gratuity. Don't get no better than that. You know, I got hired as the head of security, chief of catering for the America's Cup. From 1982 until 1987, I was the boss. I was allowed to go into places that nobody else was allowed to go into because they weren't on the America's Cup team. I got to see Dennis Connors design that famous boat that kicked everybody's butt, you know, the catamaran. I got to go on the catamaran as it was being built. I got to see what went into that catamaran. But the thing I was entrusted with was not going back out and telling you what it was going to be like. Dennis even wanted me to go to Hawaii. Now, I don't know if you guys know anything about Dennis Connors, but he was one of the biggest alcoholics we got. And it's not for me to tell you who is and who isn't an alcoholic, but I can tell you this. This man would drink anybody under the table and with some of the best stuff available. You know, he bought me back a case of red rum. And I don't know about you, but I wasn't trusting no red rum. Now, I had stopped drinking hard alcohol in 1980 because, for me, I went to work for the University of California Police Department. I was a member of their illustrious staffing. And so that was my first job. My second job, like I said, was catering. And I used to get up and go to work every day, day in, day out. And I used to ride around in that police car under the influence. And this last week that I worked for the University of California Police Department, I had pulled over into Muir parking lot, rolled three joints. I was getting ready to get out on do my midnight walk, which was go down and lock up the extension and make sure all the doors were locked up down into the extension and do my patrol. And just as I got ready to step out of my vehicle, I happened to notice another white Dodge Coronet behind me. It was my sergeant. And he said, "Okay, why don't you follow me down to the station? I want to talk to you about something." And me, like a dumbass, I followed him down to the station. Even though I knew something was up, I followed him. And when I got down there, they did a search. And they found three joints in my top pocket. And they went out to my truck, and they did another search of my truck. And they found an open gallon of Carlo Rossi wine. I had gone from drinking vodka to drinking Carlo Rossi. And that was what my drink of choice was, Carlo Rossi wine. Now, mind you, I was still working catering, and I could have any kind of wine I wanted. I could have any kind of alcohol I wanted. I had alcohol. You know, we still have alcohol at my house. We got probably a 50-year-old bottle of scotch, Cutty Sock. It's been opened. And you know what? It's still sitting there because it doesn't interest me. But my wife, for a long period of time, used to use a pencil. You know, that little red marker to see how much I was drinking. And you know, I always beat her. She'd go looking to see what I was drinking. It wasn't what she thought I was drinking. I was drinking Carlo Rossi. But guess what? I was taking that full gallon bottle and putting it in our dishwasher. Because guess what? I was the dishwasher. So I got to hide that bottle of Carlo Rossi. My wife still laughs at that today, you know. And I used to play this game of hide and seek, you know. And then I got my second DUI. And oh, let me tell you about my second DUI. It was a doozy. My first DUI was stupid. I sat in front of my ex-girlfriend's house revving the engine on my mother's Thunderbird, daring her boyfriend to come out and do something or say something to me because I had just been to that house and got myself my stuff out of that house per court order. They gave me 15 minutes to go in there. And, you know, she had a boyfriend. And he left a pair of 14 boots in that closet when I went in to go get my stuff out. Those are some big feet. I was building a catfish pond out in the backyard. Those were some nice boots. Did I tell you that? They were lizard or alligator or something. And that catfish pond had about 3 feet of water. Muddy, brackish, dirty water. Because like I said, I was digging it. It wasn't done. And I took those boots and I threw them in the water. And I started walking away, and the cop that was there to escort me to get my stuff out of the house said, "Were those your boots?" And I looked at him, and I gave him this big shit-eating grin, and I said, "Nope." And I proceeded to get out of that house. My life hasn't been all that favorable. And the reason it wasn't all that favorable is because I kept getting in the way. And I didn't know that. And when I got sober, prior to that, let me go back a little bit. Me and my friends were playing this joke on one another. We would call each other and say, "This is Raleigh Hills calling." Raleigh Hills was a treatment center. We all knew we were drunk. We all knew we were drunks. But we wanted to enforce that. You know, and there were four of us. My roommate at the time, Gary, he was this construction guy that could drink a 40-pack of beer in one night. A 40-pack of beer. I could barely drink one. He drinking 40. You know, every single night. But in between doing those 40 cans of beer, he was doing that white powdered stuff. You know, and that white powdered stuff was letting him go a little bit longer and a little bit longer. And I started seeing this because we used to hang out at Rosie O'Grady's. And so I started trying it. You know, that white powdered stuff in my nose. And it let me drink a little bit more, but I can never go more than that junior league line. It was always that little pinhead. It was no bigger than a match. But that stuff used to take me every time. It would take me to places that I didn't want to go to and venture off into places that I had been. And it didn't look that good. Oh, and let me tell you, in 1977, I shattered my lower spine in a car accident. And I had to learn how to walk again. And while I was in the hospital, they jammed me packed with this narcotic drug called Toluene. And it started out with 5, 10, 15, 100, 150, 200, 250, 300 a month. Because you see, I could come here to California and I could get those Toluene and I could go back to Connecticut, which I had moved back to in 1977. And I had another doctor back there, and he would give me another 150 more. And the insurance company paid for it because they didn't have computers back then. So they didn't know what this hand was doing as opposed to that hand was doing. You know, I had spent 45 days in Bellflower Community Hospital in a hoop. Anyhow, it was this hoop that they used to come in and turn every 4 hours, and I was in it, and I was strapped with a 50-pound weight on this side and a 50-pound weight at my ankles, and they used to come in every 4 hours and turn me over. And while I was in this hospital, my best friend, whose name was Cliff Pace, used to come and visit me every night, and we were bankers together. And he used to bring a bottle of Amaretto di Sauvignon. And every night we would sit there for 3.5 hours drinking that Amaretto. But lo and behold, I didn't tell anybody. I was on Demerol. Oh, it gets better. Not only was I on Demerol and drinking this Amaretto di Sauvignon, my girlfriend was bringing me pot. And so I was just mellowed out and buzzed out and flying low. You know, and I always wanted to be a race car driver. You laugh. I had a Datsun Z. It was lowered. It was tuned. And it would do well over 140 miles an hour. I tried doing that all the way across this country. That's why I knew it would do 140 miles an hour. I went from Los Angeles back to Connecticut in 31 hours. And when I left California, I had a gallon of wine. I called myself having, I don't know how much cocaine, and I had some marijuana. And the only time I stopped was in North Platte, Nebraska, where I got a ticket for doing 76 and a 55. And where he came from, I have no clue, because you see, in Nebraska at that time, they used to have that center rail all the way down, and you couldn't make a U-turn on the freeway. All you could do is just keep going straight. And from wherever he picked me up at until wherever he saw me at and he gave me that ticket at, he then turned around and followed me all the way from North Platte, Nebraska to Omaha, Nebraska to make sure that I didn't accelerate again, because I looked like I was kind of dangerous. I had those red, blue, green eyes. My family called them Christmas tree eyes, knowing that I am fully under the influence of something that I had no business being under. You know, and my life didn't get any better. It was just a whole bunch of series of crashes and burns. And when I got here, this is the topper. I had very little faith in God. God didn't exist in my part of the world. You could talk about God. We can have conversation about God. But that's as far as I wanted it to go. Because like I said, I was this Catholic kid. And I carried around a lot of guilt. All this guilt, all this shame, all of this stuff I carried with me. And I carried it heavily here on my shoulders. And if you tried to weigh in on what I was carrying, I didn't want to share it with you. I didn't want to let you in. I didn't want you to know who I was. And then things started getting different for me. When I went to treatment, I went to Alvarado Parkway Institute, API. And you know, the first day I was there, we had people like dog catchers running around, bringing you to the groups and the meetings and everything like that. And this one dog catcher came into the room, and his name was John. And he said, "Hey, man, come on, we're doing a meeting." "I got only 10 minutes left. Wow, I better really, really get sober, huh?" Time flies when you're having fun. You know, and he came into the room and he says, "You got to get up and do group." And I was looking at him like, "I got to get up and do what?" "I got Hunt for Red October. I'm going to finish reading this book and you're not going to make me get out of this bed." And then all of a sudden somebody else came in the room and said, "You got to come along to the group." And you know, my first week at API, I don't remember. The only way I got to know that I was there for the first week was the X-ray technician said to me, "This is going to be the second time I took your picture." And I looked at him and I said, "When was the first time?" He says, "You know, you were standing here in front of me with that black jacket on that said, Christening Staff for the America's Cup." And I was like, "Okay, yeah, I got that jacket." He goes, "Well, you were in it and I took your picture already." And I was like, "No, I don't believe you." And I went to the doctor and I told the doctor, "Hey, listen, everybody else is getting their X-rays. How come I'm not getting my X-ray?" And the doctor looked at me and said, "They did take your X-ray the second day you were here." You know? And I finally started listening to something other than my own head. The next surprise that I got while I was in treatment was this blonde, this beautiful, beautiful, tall blonde, became my drug and alcohol counselor. And her name was Jane Curtin. Jane Curtin. Close the door. Well, her husband's name was Harvey Hyber. Judge Harvey Hyber. Harvey Hyber, on the 12th of December of 1990, had promised me 5 years in prison. Because it was my second time getting a DUI. And this time I was being adamant about not working the program. I was being adamant that you couldn't make me work this program because I didn't like you folks. I didn't want to be a part of you folks. And you couldn't make me stand and become responsible to become a part of you folks. And you know, I was sitting there that Sunday morning and I was bitching about I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was complaining about what they were doing to me. And I happened to look in this front row, and there was Jane sitting there. And next to Jane was this 6'4" guy, big old bear-looking guy. And he was sitting there shaking his head like this. And I looked at him, and I looked at him, and I realized that was the judge that was getting ready to sentence me to 5 years in prison. On the 5th of January, I was going down, you know, because I had done everything, including lied to that judge. Hell, you know, when you got to go and get your paperwork signed, I was signing that shit myself. You know, I had to do volunteer time. I had to do 30 days of volunteer time. So I chose to do it down at the Central Library. But guess what? All I did was give somebody $50. And they got me that letterhead that said, Central Library. And they typed it up saying, I was attending down there as a volunteer. I was teaching the little kids how to read. I didn't like little kids, and you couldn't make me like little kids, and I surely wasn't going to read to little kids. But I paid $50 to somebody to give me this piece of paper that said I was there. I was doing that thing. And you know, Judge Heiber caught me in that lie. Because he called down to the library, dumbass. You know, he made that phone call down there to check and see if I was there. And guess what? I hadn't been. So that really pissed him off. And he was going to give me 5 years. And I had a 11-month-old son. And I had a 2-year-old wife. And my wife was this cute little 26-year-old. Just gotten out of nursing school. And oh, man, let me tell you, my eyes were following her all over that hospital. And then I had this security guard, and he was telling me that he was dating her. You know, and he was a crackhead. You know, and that's what I held against him. He was a crackhead. I was a good old alcoholic, but he was a crackhead. And he kept telling me how much he was dating this woman, and he was going out with this woman. And I said, oh, really? How come I never see you talking to her on the floor? Because you see, I was the chief of security at this hospital. You know, and I went up to this young lady and I started talking to her. And you know, I invited her out on a date and she hasn't left yet. Don't ask me why. You know, and here it is 30 years later. And she laughs. But you know, we've been on some of the best adventures we could have possibly ever been on. And the good Lord could have never given me a better partner. Because she's put up with a whole lot of my shit, including me being the person I am and enjoying the company of other women. And yes, I got busted. I got busted for being unfaithful. Me, like a dumbass, you know, I had started a business. And my business had to do with drugs and alcohol. And I had a house up in Mount Helix. And this woman that worked for me, let's just say that I let my big thing take over where my little thing should not have prevailed. And that night, I got busted. Phone rang. Me, like a dumbass, got up and answered the phone. Just finished making love to my wife. And when the phone rang and I answered the phone, guess what? She was standing over there and she heard me talking. And she wanted to know who I was talking to. And she wanted to know what I was saying, so she moved closer and she heard things that she shouldn't have heard. Because, you see, I'm not only an addict. I'm not only an alcoholic. I'm addicted to anything that makes me feel different. I'm addicted to this, my own poor thinking, you know, and my thinking would get me into places that I didn't have no clue I was going to. But the biggest thing was that once I got here, I had to learn one thing, and that was how to change everything. And they started with pulling things apart, pulling things out of me that shouldn't have come out of me. Taking me to places that I had no thought about going to. And they started helping me to change. And they started helping me become the person that I have become. And I got 2 minutes. And I got to say this. It's been one hell of a ride. I mean, like, my friend Bernie Kota, who I haven't seen in 16 years, since my house was built, has now come back into my life. Bernie and I used to do some crazy fishing. Bernie taught me how to catch some of the biggest fish that I ever learned how to catch, but then I had to go down to the Bahamas and catch one bigger. You know, Bernie taught me how to have all these fishing poles and all this fishing gear. And, you know, I even bought a boat with him. Never saw that boat. We were laughing about that tonight, you know. But my life don't get no better than this. Just got back from Europe. I got a hell of a surprise over there. I'm afraid of snakes. I'm not afraid to tell you I'm afraid of snakes. And I went to go see the Moulin Rouge. And what did they have in the Moulin Rouge? Fucking snakes. Big snakes. 18-foot snakes. And they were coming out of the ground. I'm not afraid to tell you that I went from the front all the way to the door in a blink of an eye. And my wife sat there and laughed at me as I was going that way. And she sent my brother-in-law after me, telling me to come back. And as long as I could see them snakes, I was not coming back into that room. I don't care how much we paid for it. You know, the Moulin Rouge wasn't all of that. They had snakes. That's the big thing I'm afraid of today. I'm not afraid of you. I'm not afraid of what I tell you. Because you have nothing, nothing that you can take me out with. No matter what, no matter how, I've joined this club. And this club has joined me. And together, we've walked through 27 years of my life. And I've gotten some fantastic friends. I mean some fantastic friends. Rodney, my neighbor. Joanne and her husband, Rick. Alan, who has been my 24 years, he saw me drink. He worked with me when I was drinking. And, you know, and I get to get Bernie back. These are some of the miracles that I've gotten being sober. But the best miracle that I've gotten is being able to say, I am alive. The good Lord gave me this life. And I can now look at it and say, damn, it's been one hell of a ride. And if you don't believe me, and you're new to this program, please come, stick around. Grab yourself a person with some time and see what happens to your life. You'll get on this marvelous, marvelous journey, and you don't have to give it back. You don't have to stop where you think you should stop. You can't overdrink it. You can't oversmoke it. And you surely can't oversnort it. But you know what? This life just keeps getting better and better and better. And it's taken me to places that I never thought I would be, or accomplishments that I never thought I would be able to accomplish. And it's made me the person who I am to this day. And for that, I want to thank you, each and every one of you, for completing the holiday and not going back out and getting drunk. Because, you know, I didn't have to go back out and get drunk. I didn't have to go back out and get loaded. And today, I got a woman that trusts me. And I can look her in the eyes and say, honey, I love you. And not take it for granted. She's been through some of my most excellent journeys. And I hope we got a lot more to go. Because you know what? Those jungles in Belize were awful fun. You know? And that's the way my life has been. Thanks for letting me share.